from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Marina Tuk-Tuk.
This week on War News Radio, Leaked, we hear about reporting on the Iraq war logs.
Then, we speak to media critics about WikiLeaks.
Next, we hear from some Iraqis who have encountered many obstacles in trying to obtain the simple right of having a passport. Finally, we hear about the debate surrounding closing the Guantanamo detention facility.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai admitted to regularly receiving bundles of cash from the Iranian government through his chief of staff. The payments, totaling millions of dollars, have gone toward securing the allegiance of Afghan politicians, tribal elders, and Taliban commanders. Western officials see the funds as an Iranian effort to gain influence with Karzai. Iran denies this, claiming the money is intended for reconstruction efforts.
In an announcement this week, President Karzai decided to reevaluate the deadline for a ban on private security contractors in Afghanistan. The initial deadline required contractors to cease operations by December 17th. A newly formed committee will now prepare a timetable for the disbandment of the firms. That means that firms will have until at least March to leave the country. Karzai has been pushing for a ban because private contractors are seen as responsible for causing civilian deaths.
Auditors at the U.S. Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction released a new report on Afghanistan reconstruction funds. The report revealed the lack of appropriate oversight of almost $18 billion awarded to contractors for projects over the last 3 years. The study highlighted poor coordination between various U.S. agencies responsible for funding rebuilding efforts. Because of an inadequate supervision of funds, it is extremely difficult to track exactly how and where U.S. aid has been spent.
In a new audio tape obtained by Al Jazeera, Osama bin Laden claims that Al-Qaeda is responsible for the kidnapping of 5 French citizens in Niger last month. Bin Laden asserts that the kidnapping is retaliation against France's deployment of troops to Afghanistan and a recently passed ban on the wearing of face-covering veils. Mali and Niger officials believe that the French kidnapping victims are still alive.
The Iraqi Supreme Court has ruled that the Iraqi parliament's 7 months of inactivity is unconstitutional. The court has ordered that parliament must resume its sessions within 2 weeks. However, it is still unlikely that parliament will reconvene while there is no agreement among members on a ruling coalition. Many parliament members say they will continue to boycott sessions until a decision has been reached as to who will lead the new government. Current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki or Iyad Alawi.
International watchdog group Transparency International announced Afghanistan and Iraq's new rankings in their annual Corruption Perceptions Index. Both nations showed no improvement from their poor rankings last year. Afghanistan remained the world's second most corrupt country, while Iraq dropped from 5th to 4th. The index is based on surveys of local and outside experts and business persons.
Tariq Aziz, a former foreign minister and deputy prime minister under Saddam Hussein, has been sentenced to death by Iraq's high tribunal. Aziz, at one time Iraq's highest-ranking Christian, was convicted of persecuting members of rival political parties. However, the Vatican has put pressure on Iraq not to carry out the death sentence.
This is War News Radio. Wired magazine said it was coming, and the anticipation began. Report after report said the release of a new batch of WikiLeaks documents was imminent, focusing this time on the war in Iraq, and the media was whooping itself up into a frenzy. A week later, Anjali Kadambi and Sam Hirschman take a look at how they performed. Here's Anjali.
Newly released reports reveal 15,000 previously undocumented civilian deaths in Iraq, including hundreds of deaths at checkpoints. Others detail hundreds of incidents of detainee abuse by coalition troops, and widespread abuses at the hands of American-led Iraqi authorities. Maximilian Forte, a professor of anthropology at Concordia University and blogger who has been examining the WikiLeaks documents for research, says the atrocities remain well defined in the documents even after redaction.
Certain trends, certain actions that are named, you know, actions involving beatings, torture, killings, so forth. Obviously, that detail hasn't been removed, so it's still extremely useful.
On October 22nd, WikiLeaks, a worldwide online publisher of leaked secret documents, released the Iraq War Logs, 400,000 classified American military reports from the war in Iraq. WikiLeaks selected partners in the mainstream media, the New York Times, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and others, where staffers translated the military jargon into numerous print articles and multimedia projects. But some media critics say the coverage in the United States hasn't been critical enough of the American government and the media's role in the war. Choosing what to report from hundreds of thousands of documents is a lot of work. Andy Laren is a New York Times reporter who worked on the WikiLeaks articles after the Iraq release, as well as the Afghanistan documents in July. He says the Times' main concern is getting the best stories out for its readers.
We have this hard enough task of trying to make sense of vast amount of information and find what we think might be the best stories for our readers. And that's a big task.
According to Laren, reporters at the Times collaborated, bounced ideas around, tried to confirm hypotheses, and see whether some recollections of previous reporting might be more clearly shown in the documents.
First off, everyone has, you know, wonderful story ideas where they're just thinking, what about this particular instance? Or someone will say, when I was a reporter in Baghdad, I remembered that this happened. I wonder if this is part of a larger picture, and I wonder how this plays out in these particular set of military documents. So people were drawing in part on their own experiences and partly just trying to ask big picture questions, you know, going outside of people's experiences. What else is in here, you know, that we might be able to find?
But Nir Rosen, a freelance journalist and fellow at the New York University Center of Law and Security, says a lot of the American reporting on the WikiLeaks documents has missed the point.
And as a journalist, I think this is my task, or one of them, is to show the American people the horrors of war and what they're doing, what our army is doing. And I don't think the New York Times has the same attitude, because they're much more cooperative with the government.
Danny Schechter, a blogger and filmmaker on media issues, goes a step further than Rosen.
Well, I mean, the coverage has been dreadful. What they basically did is they focused more on, like, issues that would please the American government, like, you know, Iran. Was Iran involved in they didn't really talk about, they didn't even use the word torture.
Some say international coverage has been more critical and more accurate. Rosen says the British paper The Guardian hasn't shied away from opposing the government.
Certainly The Guardian in London has a much more antagonistic relationship, which is appropriate, with the government. That's our job as journalists, is to be gadflies, is to undermine the people in power, to uncover their lies. And I think The Guardian is doing a much better job on that.
Why would the American mainstream media set out to please the government? Forte offers his explanation.
Among the reasons that some offer are the fact that newspapers such as the New York Times and, you know, others such as the Washington Post and so forth have developed over time a kind of working alliance or working relationship with institutions such as the Department of Defense and the State Department. Relationships on which they depend in order to do their reporting, you know, to become embedded in units in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. A reluctance to criticize, to critically analyze, without fear or favor, that is generally being diminished.
The media in wartime is caught in something of a catch-22. Authoritative information comes from the government, and the most effective way for journalists to get that information is to build trusted relationships with their sources. But too much cooperation can compromise their journalistic integrity. When journalists become too critical, they can lose access and find themselves with less information to report. WikiLeaks, and new models like it, can reverse the status quo by taking power away from those who controlled the information before. For War News Radio, I'm Anjali Kadambi.
This is War News Radio. The staff behind WikiLeaks and the recently released Iraq war logs is both everywhere and nowhere to be found. Sam Hirschman and Anjali Kadambi spoke with a few experts in an attempt to define the shadowy organization. Here's Sam.
There's no number to call, no email address. They have neither a doorbell nor maybe even a door. But with each new release of documents, WikiLeaks is both transforming and redefining journalism. Since it began in 2006, WikiLeaks has become the essential platform for distributing leaked secret documents online. But the release of American military reports from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have put them in the spotlight in 2010. By sharing their secrets with the global online community, WikiLeaks has disrupted the traditional top-down distribution of information. WikiLeaks may be the first to command the internet as a central medium for leaks, but leaking inside information has a long history in the United States. One of the first incidents was in 1772, when the Hutchinson Letters, a packet of letters written by the Royalist governor of Massachusetts, were given to Benjamin Franklin. Two famous leaks emerged during the Nixon administration. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, an employee of a defense contractor, gave the New York Times 7,000 classified documents showing the history of American involvement in Vietnam. In 1972, an informant known by the pseudonym Deep Throat, and later revealed to be FBI agent W. Mark Felt, led Washington Post reporters Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward to information that showed presidential involvement in a break-in at the Watergate Hotel. The scandal led to President Nixon's resignation. Recently, WikiLeaks has been the primary source for classified information. On October 22nd, it released the Iraq War Logs. They included nearly 400,000 documents. Maximilian Forte, a sociology professor at Concordia University and blogger for ZeroAnthropology.net, says the information is unlike anything else available.
It provides an alternate source of information and a much more detailed source of information than we get from the mainstream media that do have solid investigative reporting traditions. So on any level, I think the kind of service provided by WikiLeaks is really invaluable.
Nir Rosen, a freelance journalist and fellow at the New York University Center of Law and Security, claims the value of the information comes from its ability to accurately describe the events of the war.
From the point of view of an American citizen and a citizen of the world, anything that sheds light on what was happening, anything that improves our knowledge and undermines the power of elites, of politicians, of the military, and undermines war is a wonderful thing.
WikiLeaks' access to secrets is undeniable, but efforts to define the organization have been difficult. Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, has claimed it practices journalism, but Rosen doesn't think so.
Journalism has to come with analysis and research. So I think they're more of a library that you can turn to for information. But without the proper context and the research, it's absolutely useless. Most people wouldn't even be able to understand the acronyms and expressions used in these documents.
Jay Rosen, an NYU journalism professor and author of the Press Think blog, says who cares whether WikiLeaks can be called journalism? It delivers information.
What's important is informing people, and transparency, that's important, and accountability is important, and knowing what's going on. And if we find out what's going on through professional journalism, that's cool. If we find out what's going on because governments tell us directly, that's cool. If we find out what's going on because documents are released that show us what's going on, that's cool too.
Though WikiLeaks seems revolutionary, the New York Times considers WikiLeaks a source like any other, according to Andy Laren, a Times reporter who has worked on the Iraq and Afghanistan releases.
Keep in mind, we view our relationship with WikiLeaks, as the editor of the Times, Bill Keller, has said publicly, we view our relationship as that of source and reporter. They are a source with a great trove of information, but they are nonetheless a source.
Rosen doesn't think it's accurate to view WikiLeaks as just another source. He says that WikiLeaks has much more power.
What's different about WikiLeaks is that instead of capturing the source, absorbing the information and composing an account that is shared with the world, what WikiLeaks says is, work through us and we'll let you speak to the world and we'll put your documents online for everyone to see. It's clearly not like any other source, because other sources before the internet, before WikiLeaks, didn't have the power to publish themselves independently. So the power relationships are very different.
The Iraq leak has led to even more questions about WikiLeaks. Jay Rosen says it is best to resist the urge to categorize the organization. He thinks the public, and especially academics, should watch WikiLeaks with a curious eye. One thing is certain, WikiLeaks has been very successful in bringing a huge amount of secret information to light. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. In the United States, all you have to do to get a passport is submit paperwork at the nearest post office and wait about a month to get it in the mail. But in Iraq, the process is not nearly as reliable. Jesse Arian has the story. This piece first aired in July.
Mohammed Ali is an Iraqi from Mosul studying for a master's degree in French. He and several others from Mosul University have recently been given the opportunity to travel to France as part of a government-sponsored program. Though he should be excited, it's actually causing him a great deal of anxiety. He still needs to get a passport.
The university can't get passports for their students. So if I don't get a passport to get a visa from France, I can't travel to that country.
Ali, as he asked us to call him, has to be there by November, but he's worried that he's running out of time. He explains what people in his situation have to do.
When you want to travel to any country,
you have an appointment and a date to catch it. So if you have to get a passport in 2 or 3 weeks, you have to pay someone to get the passport.
In Iraq, most people expect to pay bribes for processing government paperwork, especially passports. Ali told us he will have to pay about $350 US or risk a long wait that could cost him his trip. Unfortunately, one of his professors has already missed her chance.
One of my professors had to cancel her travel because she didn't have a passport.
Calling the passport situation in Iraq a dilemma is not an exaggeration. Saddam Hussein's regime made it very difficult for Iraqis to leave the country. But after the U.S. invasion in 2003, the Iraqi government began issuing the S-Series passport. People showed up at the passport offices by the hundreds every day in order to get one. Yarob is an Iraqi student studying energy technology in the U.K. He recalls what he went through to get the S passport.
We had to go really early in the morning because we want to catch up at the beginning of the very, very long queue. It took us, I think, at least 4 hours to read the window the place we put our applications, and he tells that we can collect our passport after maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, and something happened, but I think after 2 months we went to that place and we collected our passport.
But the main problem with the S passport was its lack of security. Because they were handwritten, passports were easy to forge. It was even possible to get blank S passports, which people could fill in themselves. So in 2006, the Iraqi government issued the G-Series passport and discontinued the S-Series. Yarob was not surprised.
We were expecting to change our passport because our passport, S passport, they were really backward and they are easily to be faked by anyone. So when the government or the authorities decided to switch to G-passports, so we were more understanding the reason behind this switching between the passports. So we were expecting such change.
The G-passport was much more secure. It was machine-readable and it had holograms. But getting it was even more difficult. The issuing of the G-passport coincided with escalation of sectarian violence causing backlog. Yarob remembers those days.
So when the G password was really valuable or very difficult to get, so people used money as a way to get a passport quickly. And because the situation at that time was really, really bad, I mean, in terms of security situation, and the killing were everywhere. So people paid money to corrupted officers to get passports quickly. And I remember one guy told me he paid, at the very beginning, one of them told me he paid $900 to get one. And after maybe 6 months, one other guy told me by coincidence he paid $700.
In addition to having to pay bribes, people living outside of Baghdad face an even longer wait. Even though there is a closer passport office, Ali says he still has to travel to Baghdad.
It's very difficult to get it.
It's very difficult to get it. This is the problem of all Iraqis in all the cities. And here in Mosul, it's very difficult because the authorities are not giving out any passports. So the people in Mosul have to travel to Baghdad.
Although so many Iraqis apply for passports, some don't want to bother. An engineering student from Baghdad, who asked to be called Alino Rayan, hasn't even tried.
No, I haven't really, because it's really a messed up process. You have to go through a lot of things to be able to get it. So I think if I wanted to get one, I will suffer. So I don't know, maybe I will do one in the future, near future. I hope so.
Rayan wants one day to come to the United States.
Actually, I want to go to America, like go to maybe New York, stuff like that. I mean, my relatives are there and my friends are going there. So it's like I have to finish college and go there, you know. But the only problem is passport. So it's like I have to make up connections in order to get me one. It's really complicated.
To make things even more complicated and an even bigger headache, the Iraqi government announced this year it would issue yet another passport series. It's A this time. For War News Radio, I'm Jesse Arian.
What is the legal status of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center a year and a half into the Obama administration, and what might the future hold? Sam Hirschman spoke to legal experts about this difficult legal issue. This piece first aired in June.
President Obama promised to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay throughout his campaign. He signed an executive order on his first day in office that said the government would close the prison within a year. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, guaranteed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other architects of 9/11 would be tried in federal court in New York City. He claimed it would be the trial of the century. So far, none of this has happened. And Jack Goldsmith, former head of the Office of Legal Counsel to the President under George W. Bush, says closing Guantanamo might not even make much of a difference.
Not much of substance will be achieved if Guantanamo is closed if the detainees are sent to the United States, because they received the same legal rights on Guantanamo as they would in the United States.
Initially, because it wasn't on American soil, Guantanamo's legal ambiguities were used to justify holding detainees without charge or trial. Since then, several Supreme Court decisions have expanded the rights of detainees. A number of legal scholars, including Jack Goldsmith, believe that now Guantanamo doesn't offer any more legal leeway than a prison in the United States. For Jonathan Hafitz, a lawyer at the ACLU, the prison's legal gray areas undermine the fabric of American law.
The solution to Guantanamo is not simply closing the prison and moving the detainees to the United States and reopening Guantanamo North in Thompson, Illinois, where they've talked about a future U.S. Guantanamo or anywhere else in the country. The only way to close Guantanamo responsibly, consistent with the country's laws, constitution, and values, is to shut the prison and to release any detainee either to their home country or in resettlement in a third country other than those who are going to charge and prosecute in a federal court in accordance with the Constitution and laws of this country.
For 8 years, lawyers like Jonathan Hafitz have been arguing that Guantanamo violates international law and the U.S. Constitution. Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions says that prisoners of war may not be tortured and that they cannot be sentenced without a trial, among other protections. Though the Bush administration denied that Common Article 3 applied to Guantanamo detainees, the Supreme Court said in 2006 that it does. Hafitz believes that detention at Guantanamo has not met the Common Article 3 criteria.
Guantanamo is, from the perspective of international law, an abomination. It is the indefinite detention of individuals without charge, without trial, and now entering its eighth year.
But the conventions also say that prisoners of war can be held until the end of a conflict without charge or trial. The Supreme Court, Congress, and Presidents Bush and Obama have all said that because the U.S. is still technically engaged in an armed conflict, current practice at Guantanamo is legal.
We're allowed to detain them until the end of the conflict.
That's Jack Goldsmith again. If it's legal to detain prisoners at Guantanamo until the end of the war, that raises a new question. When are the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over? Or are they both part of one larger war on terror, as President Bush often said? And that's not the only tricky issue. When the war ends, the detainees must either be released or put on trial. The Bush administration wanted to try the Guantanamo detainees in specially conceived military tribunals, but creating a new trial system was full of problems. President Obama and his advisors have gone back and forth. Attorney General Holder has guaranteed a trial in civilian courts, but that might not happen. Jack Goldsmith thinks the trial should happen in federal courts.
For the people that we do plan to have trials for, I think, especially for the top detainees, I've written and I believe that the military commissions are not a good way to go, that they should be done in civilian trials, because the military commission has lots of legal problems that will have to be sorted out.
Regardless of how the trials proceed, if at all, the decision on how forcefully to move on Guantanamo lies with President Obama. Does he want to spend political capital to convince members of Congress the prison should be closed? How many prisoners should be released? Should the rest be tried, and how? In answering those questions, he will have to weigh what is legal, what is possible, and what is just. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Rosanna Kim, Lewis Katz, Kyle Crawford, Aaron Moser, and Amandine Lee. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Marina Tuk-Tuk. Until next time, thanks for listening.